Some people like to deep clean every Saturday morning. I prefer to spend a few minutes every day keeping things fresh with Lysol. Lysol's brand new day disinfecting wipes conveniently tackle surfaces, including remotes, tablets, and smartphones, killing 99.9% of viruses and bacteria with a fragrance that feels like a tropical getaway for your senses. Don't just clean, Lysol clean.
On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore one nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic raised bed and garden soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.
It is so important in life to learn how to be a good interviewer. Not because you're a reporter, not because you're a podcaster, but so many situations in life are quasi-interviews. Like when you're applying for a job, or when you are hiring somebody, or when you meet a girl or a guy at a party, you want to find out as much about them as quickly as possible. And you also want to make sure they have a good opinion of you if that's your goal. So being a good interviewer and having those skills is critical. And I'm so grateful that I've had this podcast and I've had to study the styles of some of the best interviewers out there. But one of the best interviewers out there has recently written an article, How to Be a Great Interviewer. And I'm talking about Polina Pompliano, who writes the newsletter, The Profile. She does profiles of so many amazing people. I highly recommend Google Polina Pompliano. She's written a book, Hidden Genius, but subscribe to her newsletter, The Profile. And she just had an edition where she didn't profile someone, but she wrote about the 10 best techniques for being a great interviewer. And she studies the greats, distills what their top 10 techniques are. I really got a lot of value out of this. So asked her to come on the podcast and we just shared stories about how to be a good interviewer. So let me know if this was valuable to you, but I'm sure it will be. Here's Polina, and we talk about how to be a great interviewer.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
You've done so many interviews through your newsletter. The newsletter, is it actually called The Profile?
It is called The Profile, yes.
Okay. And I always forget the title, but it is the one newsletter, when I get it, that's like the first newsletter I open. I just love your profiles. You're profiling everybody from billionaires to artists. And it's great because unlike a podcast, you don't feel obligated to bring the person in to your house and interview them. You just profile anybody you're interested in. It allows you to do extra research and so on.
Exactly. Yeah. And a lot of times I back my way into interviewing them. So if I really want to interview someone and I don't think I can yet, I put together like a deep dive on them and then I send it to them or their people. And I'm like, hey, look, this is my style. This is what I do. I'd love to interview you. And I've gotten a few interviews that way.
Yeah, and you've now built up such a following that I imagine, like book publishers or movie studios should be pitching you, hey, can you profile our author or actor or whatever?
Yeah, no, I get quite a few. Only a few of them are actually really, really interesting, but I read every email.
Believe me, we get I would say realistically we get about between 10 and 20 a day.
I believe it.
And sometimes I get angry, actually. Not really like angry, but I want to write back and said, why do you think this person,
yeah.
I would want to, not that, like everybody is valuable and everybody has an interesting story, but like given,
yes.
for a podcast, you have a certain brand or you have a certain type of person. You could tell the person did no research. Like, why would I want to interview somebody who I don't know. I don't want to put anybody down, but, and it's, again, it's not like I think I'm so elite, but.
No, it's the point of view of the podcast. It's like, they right. should know who they're pitching. I completely agree.
And, but you do a lot of interviews though, like for your newsletter. And like me, you study the art of the interview, which is why I love that article you wrote where you took a break from profiling and you did 10 interview techniques from the world's best interviewers. And it's really like something that I am obsessed by. Like you, you've taken a slightly different angle in your research and yeah. I, you know, everybody has their own style. And like I've looked at everybody from like Larry King to Oprah to Howard Stern to Joe Rogan, like everybody's got their own style. And it's very interesting to study people's interviewing styles because an interviewer has to, you know, unwrap this gift. And there's a lot of wrapping around the gift. But if you get to the gift yeah. itself, you get a beautiful interview.
It's so true. And the reason, I mean, I think all the, everyone who interviews people for a living, as you do, I'm sure has done this research for themselves, which is what I was doing. I was just compiling thoughts for myself to get better. And then I was like, maybe I should just like publish this because everybody's always trying to be a better conversationalist, interviewer. You know, even if you have nothing, if you don't have a podcast or an interview show, you're probably interviewing candidates for a job at your business. So it's like something everybody can benefit from.
It's so true. Like I have found that getting good at interviewing, and I'm not saying I'm great. It's like a nonstop, it's like a lifelong study to,
yes.
to you have to master it, like mastering a sport or mastering music. Interviewing is it, you're playing an instrument, which is the person you're interviewing. And that's a little, maybe not quite good, but you have to kind of, it's a path to mastery and it's difficult, exactly. but it does improve other areas of my life. Like it helps me relate to people in general and understand people and so on. Mm-hmm. Like when you're interviewing, what is your goal feeling that you want the interviewee, the person you're interviewing to have by the end of the interview?
My goal going into any interview is to make them think. I think so, especially, you know, when you interview a lot of CEOs and founders and people like that, oftentimes they're very media trained and it's really hard to break that veil or that
yes.
like pierce that smoke screen. And my goal is like, I want to have them pause after a question and be like, hold on, I've never actually thought of that or thought about it that way. And when you make them think, it's like, it humanizes them just a little bit. The problem is that it takes a while to get through that. And when I was writing this, you know, article about the interviewing techniques, I was like, how can you do that more quickly? Like, how can you build intimacy quicker so that you get there faster?
Right. Because let's say you only have a half hour to an hour
yeah.
to interview them, which really means you only have about 5 minutes, maybe even less, to make them feel comfortable with who you are as an interviewer. Because a lot of people might be on guard. And like you said, a lot of people, particularly like CEOs, or other high profile people,
yeah.
they have their media message that they like one time, I'll give just to give you an example. Like
yeah.
one time I was interviewing Tony Robbins after one of his books came out and he mm-hmm. had such a message and he's such a like a big monstrous
domineering,
guy.
yeah.
And I say this in the best possible way that he just gets on his spiel and I had to practically yell at him to interrupt. Mm. And you discuss the art of interruption in your article. We'll get to the specific techniques. And other times people don't know that when they're saying something that might be interesting, they're just kind of listing some things that have happened in their life. And they're, you know, oh, I got over a cocaine addiction. And then I did this.
Yeah.
Wait a second. How did you get the
yes.
addiction? You know, you're never going to, and people are afraid to interrupt, but you're never going to get this chance again to talk to them.
100%. And it's, yeah, it's so good. Especially like you said, Tony Robbins probably doing like 100 interviews for his book. He's on message. Even if you ask him a question, he'll probably just answer something kind of related, but not really to get his message across. And it's like the interviewers, you are definitely one of them who are actually listening. They are the ones who like rewind the tape, like, wait, let's focus on that a little bit more. And I think for me, to go back to like, if you have 30 minutes, how do you get to that intimacy quicker? What I do is often If I'm asking them to share something a little more vulnerable, I'll start first. Howard Stern does this a lot. It's like you share something about your own life or your own struggle or whatever, and that allows them to be like, oh, okay, like let me tell you my experience. It's a little like I'll give a little, you give a little, and I think that helps.
That is so interesting because that's where your interviews are different from a podcast because I can't do that so much. You know, I've done 1,500 episodes and I can't do that so much in a podcast because my listeners, they know my story. It would be very hard to reveal something new to my, you know, regular listeners. So I see where you're saying with the vulnerability and sometimes I try to do that because that's a really important thing to get out of them. But I have to kind of work around that a little bit sometimes, maybe before the interview or or maybe what I have to do is really show them how much I appreciate what they've been through.
Yes, exactly. And the pre-interview, like the time before the interview actually starts is also very important because you can build that rapport before you even start.
Yeah. And so you want them to think, you know, it's interesting. I haven't thought of it that way. What I want them to say to me afterwards is, man, that felt like a therapy session.
Yeah.
So, and then what do you want your reader or listener to think after you've done an interview?
I want them to be like, wow, I actually really learned something from this person, or there's one piece of practical something that I can take away and implement in my life. I always try to like extract something practical from the person. Because ultimately, if you're a listener of a podcast, you probably want to get better. You probably want to grow. So it's like, what is one technique that like maybe I haven't considered or maybe I haven't thought about in that way that I can implement in my day?
And do you ever get nervous or intimidated before you interview someone?
All the time. Every time.
I still do.
Really?
Yeah.
After 1,500?
I mean, I'll tell you, I first professionally was interviewing people, and my listeners know this story, but I worked for HBO in the 90s, and I did this project where I was interviewing people at 3 a.m. in New York City. So prostitutes, pimps, drug dealers, other homeless, whatever. And I would just walk up to people at 3 a.m. So you have to, there's a degree of comfort you have to make them feel very quickly. And they might have weapons. So so I've done a lot of interviews. I did thousands of those. And I was always nervous walking up to somebody. But I'm still, if someone's coming on, I'm like, almost always the 30 seconds before the interview starts, I hope they cancel. Like that's how
I have
nervous
that
I
feeling
get.
A lot too. It's so interesting, right? Like I think that being nervous is actually a good sign because you prepare. The people who are like, whatever, and they don't end up preparing and then it's not as good of an interview. I think like that nervousness is what keeps you really good.
I think so. I think, do you ever do an interview though and you feel like, man, I could have done better at that?
Totally.
Like and that then, feels really bad.
And then somehow, that happened to me recently. I was like, oh no, that fell short. And then it ended up like the listeners really liked it. It's just like, how does this happen? You know, sometimes your bar of quality is different.
That's true. But like, okay, a couple of years ago, I interviewed, before he was running for president, I interviewed RFK Jr.
Okay.
And I read his book. I read other, but you know, that was a mistake. Because when you read his, I mean, I'm glad I read his book. Yeah. And I did other research, but I didn't really, of course, you only get his side of the story on that stuff.
Right.
I didn't really realize the depth to which, you know, drug problems and other factors were, you know, formed his view of life. And I feel like I should have asked more about that, but I just wasn't as aware as I should have been.
It's hard. It's also hard. One-on-one interviews I find really difficult because you don't have the benefit of like going, I mean, I guess you could do that, but it just takes a lot of work. You could go, for example, if you're writing a profile in a magazine, you would go interview his associates, people he's worked with, family members, friends, whatever. But like this, you truly are only getting this one person's side of the story. You can't bring in different voices.
Right. And you're, I don't, like a podcaster is not a journalist. I don't consider you a journalist. You're writing something not to say, oh, I got the dirt on this person or I found out, you know, this thing they did, you know, it's a story, but you're trying to help your readers and, and give fine lessons and benefits. And okay, journalism has its role, but I think for me, it's more interesting, like your style of profile than reading an I got you, kind of story. So, because then you don't, like, I find when everybody, you know, with a lot of journalism, the journalist has an agenda that might maybe is not a friendly agenda, and they're trying to get, you know, they're trying to get some achievement in their career, which might go against the goals of their readers and the goal of the person they're interviewing.
I really truly get upset when I see something like that. There is a place for hard-hitting, you know, investigative journalism, and I will defend that to the death. What I don't like is somebody coming in being like, oh, this is a cheap shot. I'm just going to get my, you know, sound bite and move on. And in the, I mean, I don't want to like harp on it, but in the article that I wrote in parentheses, so it's not like that obvious, but I included a link to what happens when a reporter has an agenda, he's not well prepared, and he's trying to take somebody down. With Elon Musk, this reporter came in and he was just like, well, what do you think about this? And he was like, well, he was talking about Twitter and after Elon acquired it and all this stuff. And Elon was like, well, give me an example of what you're talking about. And he was like, well, I don't really use Twitter. And it's just like, oh my gosh, it's so bad, but it just shows the lack of preparation. And then Elon's able to turn it around on him. It's just super embarrassing.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point too, by the way, is that when you're being interviewed by someone who's doing that I got you style and they're never going to really be fully prepared because they have an agenda. So you have to fit in their agenda. And there are a lot of great techniques for dealing with that also. And this works like it just in general in any kind of argument, you know, like, you know, often they slightly change the subject. So instead of saying like, hey, this is how you bought Twitter, they might make it kind of their own opinion about freedom of speech. And then I don't know that particular interview you're referring to, but Elon Musk might be able to say, hey, did you just change the subject? I'm happy to talk about that, but let me know. Is that what we're talking about now? Or are we still talking about Twitter? And that's so there's ways to kind of, like, you could label what they're doing, and then that sort of throws them off a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. And it just, I think that some people get power drunk and they don't think that the subject will push back. And when they do, they kind of lose their footing and just chaos ensues.
And look, the great thing about newsletters and podcasts is these are the sorts of things that did not exist 20 years ago. Wow. You know, the technology wasn't there, the audio wasn't there. So you had to be chosen by like the New York Times or a powerful radio station or the Washington Post. And so you felt like you had status. So it was a different type of feeling that reporters and journalists had then. Whereas we sort of have created our media, and it's like you have your own magazine, I have my own radio show, but we chose ourselves to do that, so we don't have to do the I got you kind of journalism. We could be the bridge between our audience and really intelligent, smart, inspirational people, and that's a value.
And I just want to add a little nuance here. It's not that we're saying never challenge the person. That's not at all what this is. It's like, I got you versus challenging. I think actually you do this really well. And I remember when I came on your show for my book, in the beginning, you said something like, okay, but hold on. I want to challenge this point of view that you had in the book because I think it's contradictory to something else that you said. That was so good because it allowed me to explain it in more detail. And I knew that you don't just like take people's crap. Like you're not like, well, you said it, so it must be fact. Like, no, let's explore that and I'm going to challenge you. But in challenging you, I'm actually giving you an opportunity to explain yourself better.
Yeah, that's a good point because I think there's a couple things there. One is it shows, and then I really do want to get to your techniques.
Yeah, sorry.
but when I do something like that, A, it's because I'm really curious why, or maybe there's something I didn't understand. Like I am trusting you, so I'm trying to figure out what didn't I understand. And then B, like you said, it allows to get more information out and to dig a little further. But also C, there's a slight part where I'm showing you how deeply I read your book. It's a way of showing respect to you. So then you become more comfortable in the interview, or whoever I'm interviewing becomes more comfortable. So many interviewers don't read their latest books or the things they're trying to promote. So then what's the point? And I always want to make sure, not only do I prepare questions, but I prepare how am I going to demonstrate that I have studied them more than anyone else.
Exactly.
So it's a little selfish.
And it reflects in your questions, and it shows that you're genuinely curious, which is one of the things, a cornerstone of an interviewing technique.
Take a quick break. If you like this episode, I'd really, really appreciate it. It means so much to me. Please share it with your friends and subscribe to the podcast. Email me at altitra@gmail.com and tell me why you subscribed. Thanks.
Escape to Ocean City, Maryland, and discover a place that just feels lighter, where every day feels like Saturday, and French fries are a food group, where flip-flops are always in fashion, and seafood is always in season, where the boardwalk is bustling, and the beach is right outside your door, where you can rise with the tide and feel like a kid again. Ocean City, Maryland, somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at OCOcean.com.
On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore one nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic raised bed and garden soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.
Let's see your techniques, because you've studied so many of these great interviewers. So the first thing you say is they know the first question. This is so important. A great interviewer knows the first question sets the tone for the entire interview. And you give an example. You give two examples of Zuckerberg. Tim Ferriss, who's a great podcaster, his first question was about fencing. And Zuckerberg, who's constantly being challenged in the media, he just opened up and relaxed and like, they're friends, which is what you want as an interviewer, you know, as a goal, like become instant friends. Whereas somebody else interviewed Zuckerberg or Kara Swisher and was like, tell me, you know, why are you anti-privacy or whatever she said.
Take off your hoodie, you're sweating through it. Like it's just a dressing down of literally and figuratively.
So like, I wonder if that was her goal, was just to kind of show her readers that she could be tough or if she really thought that would be a good interviewing technique to kind of throw them off real quickly.
Well, I mean, that's kind of her thing, but also I think it's two different contexts. Tim Ferriss was interviewing him on a podcast, so they had 2 hours. She was interviewing Zuckerberg on stage, and maybe they had like, I don't know, 30 minutes, 15 minutes. So they have to get there faster. She has to ask those questions faster. The problem is that you risk burning the subject that you're trying to interview. Mark Zuckerberg, after that interview with Kara Swisher, did not do an interview with her for 8 years. In that period of time, Facebook became Facebook. So, I mean, you risk that. But also, you know, when you go straight into the meat, the person's on the defensive. Like, they're on guard. They're not going to be as open. Whereas when Tim Ferriss starts like that with fencing, it opens up Zuckerberg, and naturally as a human being, if Tim Ferriss brings up a difficult subject later in the interview, it's just, you've built that rapport, so it's easier to ask and respond to the hard questions.
Yeah, but I wonder, like, let's say you were Kara Swisher in that case.
Yeah.
What would you have, let's say you only have 30 minutes. I don't know how much time she had. Let's say you only had 30 minutes and you wanted to, but you being Polina, you wanted to start with an interview that is more warm and friendly the way Tim Ferriss did. Like, what would you have done?
I think just the first question wouldn't have been a direct, what are you doing about privacy? Maybe I would have started with an anecdote of someone using the platform and, something adjacent to the privacy question. And then I would have gotten there. It's just the first three questions of her and her colleagues when they were interviewing Zuckerberg were about privacy. Like, maybe let's just open it up with something that, like, it is a little, sets the tone that this is what we're going to talk about, but it's softer, and then go into the more direct.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Like, I think what I would have done, like you said, fencing might be too long
That's
of
too
a subject.
Far. Yeah.
But I might have said something like, you know, I just want to mention in 2006, the first time I turned on Facebook,
exactly.
It was the most
like
amazing
that.
Experience for me. I could finally see what my friends from first grade are doing now. I would never call them, but I could see how their kids' soccer game did last night. Like,
here's how I would do it. Sorry to interrupt
it.
You.
Yeah.
I would, for example, I would say, you know, Mark, like, Facebook is amazing for somebody like me because I get to, for the first time, you guys, you know, your company gave me the opportunity to connect with family in Bulgaria, where previously I had no contact with, like, we couldn't share photos like this as easily, whatever. And then I would say, by the way, I noticed that my grandmother in Bulgaria is posting links to things that's definitely misinformation and it's kind of propaganda. How are you guys handling that with my grandmother in Bulgaria? Something like that where it's not as abrasive.
Yeah, right. Like, that's really good. Cause then you could say, like, does she need to be worried because the government in Bulgaria? And then what about, and then you could always bring that in. What about people here in the US? Is it different? Is it the same? Like, why are people worried about privacy here?
Exactly.
Yeah, that would have been good. And, you know, all of this stuff is important too for a job. Like, let's say you're just going for a job at some random bank. So it's like sort of generic. It's very important to research and figure out how to connect. Yeah. Like, why this bank? Why this person? Why are you sitting there? Like, what's happening that's beyond just money and, you know, doing work that connects you to this experience? I think it's important to always think of these interview questions.
Exactly. When I was interviewing at Fortune, you know, I go in to interview for a job, but if I hadn't researched the person who was interviewing me, I would have never known that she got her PhD at the same university where I graduated from. That's a huge, like, connective, you know, thing that we could talk about. But if I hadn't done my research on her, I wouldn't have known that. And it would have just been like any generic interview she'd done that day.
I'll tell you, like, that is incredibly valuable. That's the most valuable thing that's going to come out of this particular podcast. Because
tell me.
just that type of thing, when you research the people in advance that you're going to talk to in a job situation or some professional business situation. Of course, it's obvious that we do this in interviews, or we should, but not everybody does that for a job interview or the first time you meet somebody in a professional setting. Like, I've had companies actually acquired from me because I've done that level of research. Like, one time I met the CFO of a company that was acquiring my company at the time. Yeah. And I learned that he went to Grinnell College. And, you know, we were both, I had a finance company that I was selling.
Yeah.
I said, you know, Grinnell College, of course. And I then, there was the CFO and the CEO in the room. I explained to the CEO, you got to really know that Grinnell College is an important case study because they have the fastest growing endowment. Because a young man by the name of Warren Buffett is sitting on their board of trustees.
Wow.
And so that ingratiated the CFO to me.
Exactly.
You know, the CEO learned something. Was able to, like, you know, show everybody I knew what I was doing. So
exactly.
It's stuff like that is really valuable.
It's small, but it's like we're human beings. It makes you more likable to me, you know?
Yeah. And again, like, no matter what, an interview, the interviewee is nervous also. They want to be at ease. You only have an hour together. You want to be able to maybe interview them later. Like you said, Mark Zuckerberg didn't go back to Kara Swisher for 8 years. I'm surprised he went back at all. But I guess that's his job too, to be the face of his company. But it's important. So, you got to set the tone. Number two, by the way, you start mentioning Larry King.
Yes.
And Larry King is an excellent person to study because he specifically, and you mentioned he's conducted 60,000 interviews.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And he did not research on purpose mm-hmm. the people he would interview because he wanted it to be fresh. Like the listener might not know who.
But he really listened while the interview was going
yes.
on.
Yes. Yeah. But what do you think of that approach of not doing any research at all?
I think it works for some people. It would not work for me. I think I would be too nervous that I didn't touch on something that I should have touched on. And also I would be nervous that I'm just asking the same questions they've already been asked 10 billion times. But like the experts, the masters of their craft, you know, they know what they're doing. And it works for some people, but you just got to know.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it would work for me either. Yeah. But sometimes when you do too much research, I have to make sure the listener knows what I'm talking about.
The context, yeah.
So sometimes it's a fine line to navigate, but I agree. I have to do the research. I'm impressed with Larry King, but there are some funny stories because Larry King does it this way. Like he famously asked Jerry Seinfeld in an interview, you know, how did you feel when your show was canceled? And Jerry Seinfeld was like, Larry, do you know who I am?
Yeah, exactly. But like that makes for a great, great television.
Yeah, it's true. Your second one's really interesting. Your second point is a good interviewer explores the gap between expectation and reality. So mm-hmm. like, give me an example.
Yeah. So, okay. I learned this from Brandon Stanton, who's the photographer behind Humans of New York. He interviews regular people on a daily basis, and he often has like 10 or 15 minutes with them. It's not, you know, 2 hours. So he's like, how do you build intimacy quickly? One of the questions that he asks is, how has your life turned out differently than you expected it to? And the reason that's such a powerful question is because it introduces conflict, like internal turmoil in the subject. They're like, oh man, like I really thought my life would be this way, but then I got this drug addiction and now it's this way. And you see how like, it's almost like the life unlived, all the different possibilities of the way your life could have turned out and the way it actually did. So it forces the subject to kind of consider two realities and build a connection between them and be like, this is the reason why my life did not turn out this way.
Yeah, that is really good. You know, I've never tried that question. That's a really good way to get fast intimacy. Yeah. And you mentioned Ira Glass also in that.
He does the same thing. He says, how did you think the situation was going to work out before it happened? And then how did it really work out? It's something in my book, I talk about Aaron Sorkin, who wrote The Social Network and a bunch of other films, but he talks about a good story has to have conflict and intent. And this is what this question has. It has conflict and has intent. What did you want to happen versus what actually happened because of all these challenges that stood in the way?
And, you know, I wonder, like, so Ira Glass's version of this, as you just said, how did you think the situation was going to work out before it happened? And then how did it really work out? That's kind of a broader.
Yeah.
That you know, so Brandon Stanton's, how does your life turned out differently mm-hmm. than you expected it to. The situation there is your life.
Yes.
But Ira Glass broadens it out. It could be any situation, not just your life. What's another, is there any other kind of way to bring up that kind of conflict real quickly like that?
Well, I was going to say like that, so that, I call that a gap question. Like how did this work out and how did you think it would work out and how did it actually work out? You could also get a lot out of the person and their decision making if you dig a little deeper and be like, well, were you worried? What were you doing in that gap? Like, were you worrying about how it was going to turn out? Were you, you know, you were just like, whatever, like, who cares? Like, it tells you a lot about the person's mentality and how they look at problems and how they solve problems. But I think another... to answer your question, another way to ask that could be like, because we're assuming that a person had a vision of something amazing that would have happened and it actually did not work out. But if you were to ask me that question, I would have said, I actually thought my life would be way worse than it turned out. You know what I mean?
I was wondering that when you were saying this, because a lot of this, like, it's almost like when Brandon Stanton's interviewing people, everybody's mildly depressed that things didn't work out the way they thought. So, but it what you just said about, okay, so there's this gap, but then the follow-up questions, how do they deal with that gap? That's yes. where the meat is.
Yes.
So it's like you open the gap and then that's where you're kind of,
yeah,
you know, getting the seeds and getting the real meat of the fruit there.
In the article, I say exploring the gap can give you a window into how the subject feels about their life. Like, do they have regrets about the past, or are they grateful for their present? Are they proud of the choices they made, or do they wish they could have a do-over? So it's like, it's introducing regret. Another good question is like, what is something in your life that you regret happened, or that you regret a decision that you made, something like that?
So let me ask you about that, because a lot of people say it's almost like a cliche for people to answer that, oh, I have no regrets because
I know it pisses
otherwise
me
I
off.
Wouldn't. Yeah. And like, people do really have regrets.
Of course.
So,
they do.
Okay. Yes, if you did this differently in 2012, maybe your babies would be different.
Right.
Like,
right.
Since then. So I get that. Like, in a science fiction sense, you have no regrets. But really, like, so how do you dig deeper for that? How do you dig deeper for the actual regrets?
I think you set the stage of assuming you would still end up in the same place. Do you have something that you regret that you wish you could do over?
Yeah, that's a good way to do it. So you get rid of their objection.
Yes.
Because the one objection is that I don't really want anything right now to change, but you know. So, okay, so number three, and this is a good one, because I always am trying to figure out Joe Rogan, who obviously has the most popular podcast on the planet, and I really enjoy the way he has conversations, and they are interviews, but they don't seem like it. So, So number three is a great interviewer mirrors to gather more intel. So maybe describe what that is.
Yeah, I actually think you did it earlier, so we'll have to listen back. But basically, what Joe Rogan and a lot of really, really amazing interviewers do is a technique called mirroring, which is I'll say something and I'll stop. And then the interviewer will take the last phrase of my last sentence and turn it into a question. So the example I gave is somebody went on Joe Rogan's podcast and she said a statistic, 42% of the rising generation have had a mental health diagnosis. And then he said, 42% of kids have a mental health diagnosis. So he's just repeating back her statement as a question, expecting her to elaborate more.
Yeah. And I think that is really valuable, because A, it shows that, you know, that's valuable on a couple different layers. One is, as you point out, that forces them to go beyond the statistic and add more context and information and so on, and maybe tell a story. But it also makes Joe Rogan, in that specific case, the voice of the 10 million listeners or 50, however, you know, the millions of listeners, like, because we're all skeptical of it too, or we don't really, it's mind-boggling, or how do we understand, make sense of that statistic? And so he becomes the voice of all of his readers, as opposed to being Joe Rogan interviewing somebody.
Yeah. And it, like, you're right. It asks a question out of genuine curiosity, but it also introduces skepticism. Is that true? And they end up looking it up on the show to see if it was true.
How does he, like, a lot of times he just gets into these just conversations with people, though. Like, he'll have like, I saw one recently, like Louis C.K. was on his show and they were just talking about the benefits of cold showers, you know, the Wim Hof cold shower, you know, cold plunges method. And Joe Rogan was saying it was good. And Louis C.K. is like, I don't really care.
Yeah.
And he, I guess he sort of trusted Louis C.K. is an interesting enough guest that they could talk about anything and it'll be interesting content, which is hard to do really for many podcasts and interviews. Like, you can't just let the topics be about anything. But Joe Rogan does it really well.
Yes. And But also, like, right now, the way we're talking, this is how we would be talking even if this wasn't being recorded. But it's also because this is my, I think, third time on your show. So I feel very comfortable with you. If it was my first time, I would be like, well, number three says that they explore the gap, right. And, you know?
Right.
So it's like he's already, Louis C.K. is his friend. So it's like almost as if we are listening to a conversation between friends, and that's the magic of it.
I think that's right. And I think, like, my favorite podcast, I don't know, and I would probably have to say my best podcasts have been where it's a repeat guest.
Yes.
And so I pretty early on, I learned the value of having repeat guests, like just continuing the conversation we've always been having. And that is a great technique. And that's what Joe Rogan does. He basically just has his friends on.
Yeah.
And and they just have a fun time.
Multiple times, yeah. I mean, he's the king of repeat guests.
And I guess, like, that's true for Howard Stern as well.
Mm-hmm.
And because because people are listening for them. Like, you turn into Joe Rogan, maybe in part for the guest, but also largely because, his listeners love him. Howard Stern's listeners love him. Oprah's listeners love her. Almost doesn't matter who they're interviewing.
Yeah, and it's also, there's something about the interviewing your friend thing where if you have some sort of relationship or connection or friendship before the interview, the interviewer, it's not as abrasive for them to ask a hard question, you know? Like, if somebody says something and they're my friend, I'd be like, come on, you know that's complete BS. Can you tell the actual story? You know, like, that's not as, versus if I didn't know them and I said that.
Yeah, and I think the goal in an interview, let's say it's a first-time guest, my goal always is to try to get to that point as quickly mm-hmm. as possible in the interview. And sometimes it's not easy. Like, it's really hard to kind of get that level of intimacy in a first interview. But I try to get that, but it's difficult.
Yeah, definitely.
Escape to Ocean City, Maryland, and discover a place that just feels lighter, where every day feels like Saturday, and French fries are a food group, where flip-flops are always in fashion, and seafood is always in season, where the boardwalk is bustling, and the beach is right outside your door, where you can rise with the tide and feel like a kid again. Ocean City, Maryland, somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at OCOcean.com.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
Now, number four here is, and this is one that is a critical one because I used to be accused of doing this. When I first started my podcast, people would say to me, let your subject talk. And so number four you have is a great interviewer masters the art of interruption. The best interviewers know when to interject. And you have a great example. What can you talk about your example?
Yes. You have to interject. Otherwise, I personally really hate it when somebody goes on and on and on. And then they make so many points in that really long monologue, but the host hasn't stopped them to explore it. So they just go unexamined. A really good example is Oprah with her Prince Harry and Meghan Markle bombshell interview that everybody tuned in to watch. So Oprah going into this knows that this is going to be watched by millions of people. She's well aware of the pressure. She knows that she can't just let Meghan and Harry talk and say whatever they want. She has to interrupt them and examine every single thing that they say. So at one point, Meghan Markle says something like, well, the palace was really concerned with what color skin my baby would have before he was born. And Oprah just, I don't think Meghan meant, I think it just kind of came out. I don't think she planned to say this. You see her like starting to like fidget in her seat. She gets super uncomfortable. Oprah goes, hold, she like throws her hands up in there, says, hold on, hold on. I have to, she says, hold up, stop right now. And she goes, there was a conversation with you about how dark your baby is going to be. So she, again, mirrors, says exactly what Meghan Markle said in her last communication, but she does it in this like big showy manner. Now the spotlight is back on Meghan, and Meghan's like, oh, actually, no, it wasn't a conversation with me. It was with Harry. I wasn't there. Also, she says she didn't hear it directly from the source, and she declines to reveal who said it because it may be too damaging. Sure. If Oprah hadn't stopped her, people would assume that somebody told Meghan to her face, what color skin will your baby? Like, it's crazy. So it's in that way. As an interviewer, you're almost like you're fact checking on the fly. And that's what Oprah did here. It was really, really well done.
And also, I guess, Meghan, if Oprah hadn't done that, maybe Meghan would have been obsessing in her mind for the rest of the interview, like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
What did I say? Do I have to clarify this? So Oprah gives her a chance to kind of like soften it.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
And that builds a rapport and a relationship. And you would give another example with Letterman and Kim Kardashian about her political views.
And so good.
Yeah. Like, you know, that's a bigger example. But, and you mentioned though that Letterman is an interesting interviewer because he's so quirky. I'm not even quite sure that he is, you know, if it's a style you want to aspire to, because his interviews are very quick and a lot of it is surfaced, even in not so much in his Netflix show, but or his older Netflix show, but in his main late night show that he did for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's really just trying to get laughs from the audience and maybe a tiny spark in the interview. So it's not that intense, but he does, I would say more than interruption, he does like what I would call like a pattern disrupt. It's like he'll do something weird.
Yes. And David Letterman, for me, is one of the weirdest. Like, I have a really hard time watching his interviews because I'm like, he interrupts, I think, too much. But it's part of his thing. And then he'll say something about himself. And I'm like, David, I don't want to know this about you. I want to hear about Kim Kardashian. But, like, that's part of his style. And, again, it's very hard to imitate because it's him. It's very much him. And in this example, for the people listening who haven't read the article, he basically sits down with Kim Kardashian. He wants to ask her about her political loyalties because she's previously endorsed Hillary Clinton, but then she worked with Donald Trump to get this woman out of prison. So Letterman goes, do you feel like what's being done on behalf of sentencing reform now via this current administration in any way allows the balance of democracy back in a corridor of viability? And Kim Kardashian is like, I have no idea what you just said. He goes, I'll try again. I'm grateful for what you're doing, but it doesn't make me feel better about the current administration. She starts answering. I understand. And he interrupts her very abruptly and goes, let me ask you, who are you voting for? And so, like, I think part of his technique, and I don't even know if he does this consciously, he starts out in this very, like, confusing place. He confuses his interviewee. By the time they figure out what's going on, he just interrupts with a very direct question. And in this way, as the interviewee, you want to answer because you now understand the question.
You know, and I wonder, I don't know if he does that consciously because I think he's a very like smart, intellectual guy. So he might have been wondering, oh.
The corridors of democracy.
Right. Like he might be thinking like, oh, Hillary Clinton, what is she doing with Trump? So he's thinking of it in this very nuanced political way. Maybe he realizes in the interview that he really just wants to know who she's voting for.
Yes, that could very much be it.
And also he realizes he's I don't want to say he's speaking above her head. I'm sure she's very intelligent also, but maybe he realized he wasn't being so clear. And so then he's smart enough to get as direct as possible.
Yes, exactly.
By the way, why can't she? Just because she likes one candidate,
I know.
Why can't she do something effective for somebody who's president of the United States, regardless of who they are?
That's how polarized we've become. We cannot have this dichotomy of Kim Kardashian, James.
Right. Like people on both sides, people are willing to break the law to get their candidate in. And it's just like, just ridiculous how polarizing people have been, as opposed to wanting to just do good in society.
Exactly. I agree.
Let's see. Number five, they make assumptions on purpose. And I think that's a little bit of the gotcha thing as well. But you use the Oprah example again.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be done in a gotcha way. It could be like, here's how I understand it. And then you let the person agree or disagree with you. I think in this one, I wanted to talk about how the interviewer is a representative of their reader or listener or whatever. So Oprah knew that, and she kind of addressed the elephant in the room, which was she knew that the person watching at home is watching this, and Harry is kind of painting himself as the victim of the system. And she's like, oh man, I know what people are thinking. I have to ask it. And so she says, and it's not done in a very confrontational way, just kind of like in a funny way. She says, please explain how you, Prince Harry, raised in a palace in a life of privilege, literally a prince, how you were trapped. And so it's like she makes it, you know, she addresses that, and then he, and then he responds with, oh, well, it's a system of wealth and all this stuff that you're trapped in, but she doesn't buy his response. So she makes the assumption. She says, so the impression of the world, maybe it's a false impression, is that all these years before Meghan, you were living your life as a royal, Prince Harry, the beloved Prince Harry, and that you were enjoying that life. We didn't get the impression that you were feeling trapped in that life. So she says, like, here's what we assumed. Is that true or not? And it forces him to take a stance.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because as opposed to the Joe Rogan example, where he really becomes the voice of the listener, like, oh, we're all of us 10 million people are skeptical or we want to know more about this thing. She's almost like a translator. Like it's as if there's a gap between she understands there's a gap between what her audience thinks and what Harry is saying. And she's trying to bridge that gap as opposed to just being the voice of the listener. She's trying to translate
exactly
what the listener might be thinking and what Harry might be thinking. So there's an intersection.
Yeah, she keeps giving them the opportunity to explain themselves. And then I watched an interview with her about her interview. And she said, that's all I was trying to do. I was just trying to let them explain their decision. And, you know, I think she did a great job.
Yeah. And so Howard Stern, how does he, you mentioned Howard Stern too. I have my own thoughts on his style, but can you talk about the example you give for Howard Stern?
Yeah, so I will admit I was not a big Howard Stern listener until I wrote this. And then a bunch of people told me to go, you know, watch and listen to his interviews. And what I noticed is that I don't know if he thinks that he knows these people or he just like makes assumptions and lets them elaborate. But for example, with Lindsay Lohan, he said a bunch of stuff where he assumed things about how she thinks. And he says, you know, when you see like an Emma Stone or a Jessica Chastain, they got a similar look to you. I can tell you've thought about this. When you see some of those movies, don't you sit there and go, oh, I can effing do those movies. It's got to be driving you nuts. So he claims that he knows how Lindsay Lohan feels. And she's like, yeah, that is exactly what I think.
You know, that's interesting, like kind of putting yourself on the side of the interviewee, like the person you're interviewing.
Yeah.
And he does that very good. And they go along with it because, look, he's a very powerful guy. So, yeah, and he's kind of taking their side. So I think with him, he's very interesting because I think he tries to get dirt about everybody during the interview. And at first I noticed in a lot of interviews, people say, no, I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah.
But then by doing this technique, he kind of gets in their head enough and he's on their side and he's not the listener's voice. He's their voice.
Yes.
And finally they're like, oh, I'm talking to myself. So finally they are able to, like I saw him interview Jonah Hill once and he was like, so when you had your first role, did you start like having sex with a lot of girls? Like even though you're kind of fat. Like he's just very direct. And he's like, and Jonah Hill's really uncomfortable. He's like, oh, Howard, I don't want to talk about that. Can we just talk about the movie? So they talk about the movie and then he's doing this where he's like on their side. But he keeps every now and then, he'll ask like the real harsh question. And Jonah Hill will be like, I don't want to. But by the end, Jonah Hill's like listing all the girls he had sex with.
No way.
Yeah, like he just works his way in and he just keeps poking, but then he'll get back to like, oh man, I'm on your side. I'm like, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's, he uses this technique that you're talking about to sort of get inside and the person's head, and then finally they're super comfortable, so they say, they forget they're on the radio and they're.
I forget which celebrity it was, but they were explaining the experience of why they shared so much on the show. And they were like, it almost feels like you enter this like different thing and there's no cameras, there's nothing. You forget that all this stuff is around you and you're just having a conversation and then it ends and you're like, what did I just say? You know, it's like that feeling of what just happened. And that's the best interviewers make it seem like time just flies by and you don't even know what's going on.
Yeah, I've heard that too from people who have been on Stern's show, that at first they tell themselves in advance, yes, I am not going to talk about X, Y, and Z. And by the end, they can't figure out how it happened, but they talked about all of those things they didn't want to talk about.
Crazy.
So number six here is the great interviewers remove barriers to enhance intimacy. And yeah. I love this example of Sean Evans.
Sean Evans, yeah. So usually the obvious example is you remove chairs or you remove tables and things like that in between the interviewer and interviewee to build intimacy quickly. So Oprah will sit on the same couch, like things like that. But it's not just physical objects that you can remove to build intimacy. It's sometimes like Sean Evans with the hot ones, where they eat progressively hotter chicken wings throughout the interview. You're removing like the barrier of like, you're breaking down the guest's composure because everybody comes in like super glam, ready to do this interview. And then by the end, when they're eating a really spicy chicken wing, like they're crying, their nose is running, their throat is burning. You know, a lot of them just can't handle it. And you see like Tyra Banks had a ridiculous reaction on the show. You see their true, true colors. I included this clip of Sydney Sweeney, but she's really trying so hard to hold on to her composure. And she's like, please, like, her voice is shaking. It's super high pitch. It's fascinating to watch.
So what do you do? Like I used to do podcasts in person before COVID, but since COVID, very rare that I do a podcast in person. And you probably interview on the phone or Zoom or whatever. Like, how do you do this technique if there's a lot of like built-in barriers?
Yeah, I mean, it's super hard to do because normally the best interviews, especially the ones like magazine profiles, for example, you're often doing an activity with the person. So you know, whether you're at a restaurant having dinner, you see how they move through the world, how they treat the waiter, how they, you know, all this stuff, context clues that they can't just tell you, I'm a generous person. Well, you didn't even leave a tip, you know, like that kind of thing. Like this is hard because I can tell you how great I am, but unless you see me in my natural habitat, it's hard. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it's the repeat guest thing is one way. So you're gonna have a hard time that first time, but then it gets easier. I think the pre-interview, like, you know, you're on for a little bit and you're just chatting, but I think it's really hard. Or sometimes I'll try to do an activity and then a week later do an interview. But that's rare. So it's hard to do that.
And also, one interesting thing, it could be that you found out a really interesting piece of information about the person and you bring it up like in the middle of the interview. It's kind of like a small bomb that goes off where it's like, oh, wow, how did you know this? And that breaks down the little, like the facade a little bit.
That I try to do. So I try to find like odd things in their background that I could bring up and then connect with things they might be saying now. Mm-hmm. I don't really have a good example, but you know, like you mentioned before, how like you read you knew someone did their PhD at your university.
Exactly.
So I might go as far as to read the PhD, the thesis they wrote, and try to find some connection between that thesis and what's going on in their lives right now, and or relate it to something they're doing now in a way that they might not even have thought of. And so I'll try to kind of like, you know, confuse them with over-researching.
Exactly. Exactly. Just like something that's unconventional, they're not expecting.
Yeah. Now, this is a really important one. And number seven here is a great interviewer strives to capture the juice of the story. And you have Barbara Walters interviewing Monica Lewinsky. And there's a lot of different angles. It's like a, you know, it's a president of the United States. It's this sexual thing. So everybody wants to hear like the sexiest details, as sordid as it might be. But with this example you give about Monica Lewinsky and Barbara Walters, it really is the juice of the story, like how she was worried about what her mother would think. And we can all relate to that, doing something that's going to be public and like, oh, what are people going to think if they find this out? Yeah. Like, and that's, that, you know, Barbara Walters is really good at that.
Yes. And it's like, it's oh, it's such a good interview for so many reasons, but it's mainly because Barbara Walters knows that she doesn't go there. I mean, she asks all the direct newsworthy questions, but what she does is like, she gets into Monica's head. And by the end, you're like, I get it. I get why she's in love with Bill Clinton. But also at the same time, you're like, I cannot believe this happened. It's fascinating. It's like a masterclass in interviewing. And she humanizes Monica to the point where you're like, wow, like, you know, young girl, bad decision making, all this stuff, irresponsible president. But it's like she refers to the juice is the details of the story that humanize the person that you're interviewing. And Barbara says, don't be so intent on getting just the facts that you take out all the juice.
Yeah. And it's interesting because she kind of layers into this. So like, you know, you like Lewinsky says, I felt very responsible. And Barbara Walters says, responsible for what?
Exactly.
And by the way, there's a nuance there because she didn't say, why do you feel responsible?
Yeah.
That would have taken it in a completely different direction. Lewinsky said, well, I agreed to go into his office, blah, blah, blah. Instead, she says, responsible for what? And that led to the discussion of her mother. But then that allows her to get enough intimacy with Monica that she says, Monica, are you still in love with Bill Clinton?
Right.
Like, and she uses Monica's name. She says, Monica. She doesn't say, are you still in love with Bill Clinton? So it's more personal when she uses the name. And if she had started off with, are you still in love with Bill Clinton? I think that would have been a different answer, different interview then.
Yeah. The whole interview like builds on itself. It's fascinating to watch.
I think that's really hard. I think, and as you mentioned later, the only way to get that skill is doing lots of interviews.
Yeah. It's true. And it's like you notice so many things as you're watching it. Like at one point, Monica Lewinsky, I didn't include this, but in the interview she says, you know, at one point my mom, like I couldn't shower alone. My mom would sit in the bathroom with me while I showered because they were all afraid that I might do something. She's obviously talking about like, you know, might take her own life. But Barbara Walters is very skilled at like knowing when to dig deeper and knowing when to kind of back off. And she says this in another interview. Barbara Walters says this. She's like, you know, for the really, really painful stuff, I'm not going to keep digging until I break you, basically. I'm going to like get there and then back off. And that's a skill. And that's like a, you know, social awareness skill that not everybody has.
And also knowing that she could go back to it later. Yeah. Like she's patient, Barbara Walters. And again, she's almost become a cliche interviewer. I mean, not her, but like just the way people think about her. But I think people underestimate her full power as an interviewer, Barbara Walters.
Totally.
I mean, because then later on she's doing stuff like The View and all that. But like you give an example in the next thing, challenging a subject's perspective with genuine curiosity. She interviewed the Shah of Iran, you know, right before he's getting overthrown. Like she was like the biggest interviewer on the planet at that point.
I know. And it's interesting. A lot of times she became friends. I think that was kind of like, wait a second. She became friends with the people that she interviewed. She became friends with Monica Lewinsky. And I believe the Shah of Iran. But it's interesting because like, I do think like a really in-depth human interview has no choice but to leave the people like, oh, we know each other on a different level, you know?
Yeah, I think when you really are able to go a couple layers deep And then, you know, she was trying to ask him and talk to him about his views on women.
Yeah.
And, you know, coming from a Muslim country and so on.
In 1977.
Yeah. Yeah. Which was, you know, on the one hand, I don't know how completely we treat women differently now, but at least at that point in the 70s was the height of the, you know, Gloria Steinem's original feminism movement, mm-hmm. and things like the Equal Rights Amendment were being discussed. And so it was a different conversation, but it was still a very, a big conversation in America, maybe for the first time. And I don't know, it might've actually been, you know, then a year later he's overthrown and the U.S. really didn't help him. And we got left with what we have now, this kind of, you know, religious, you know, super religious government in Iran that most of the people don't like. Most of the people wanted the Shah of Iran in Iran. And now most, you know, 80 million people in Iran are secular and they're ruled by this super religious establishment.
I did not know any of this. Okay.
Like Iran does not like their government. Like the people there, and that's why they literally beg the outside world to understand this, because they don't want to get bombed if their government does something. Like they prefer not to be, they were a completely Western country under the Shah, almost, not completely, mm-hmm. but almost. And now they're not, but they want people to know that so that they don't get blamed. If like Iran bombs Israel, they don't want to get bombed back because they're not like their government.
I'm gonna do some research after this.
Yeah, and I think that was a mistake for Jimmy Carter at the time to not help the Shah a little more, because we didn't like some of the things he did, but that's like every country in the world. We don't like most of the things the French do either, but we're still their ally.
Oh, that's so fascinating. There's so many layers here.
Yeah. And Barbara Walters is, you know, I think she understood that, like, he's a dictator, but he was still kind of our friend. And then you don't condone everything your friends do, obviously, and particularly at that geopolitical level, but he was certainly much better than what happened. You know, number 9 is they know all humans seek genuine validation. And this is really important too.
Yeah, this I found fascinating because Oprah talks about how pretty much every person that she's interviewed, including George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Beyonce, anybody she's interviewed, after the interview ends, they always ask her, I bet you get this question too. They're like, ooh, was that good? Was that okay? And it's like, and she's like, what do you mean? You're Beyonce. Of course it was okay. But like everybody has that small piece of them that's like, did you like what I said? And do you think this will resonate with people? And I think a great interviewer's job is to make the person feel validated and actually listened to during the interview.
Yeah. And I think this happens at every level. Like, so for many years I did stand-up comedy and then I owned part of a stand-up comedy club. So I would see all these great comedians perform on stage. You know, they'd be trying out material for their special or whatever. And no matter how famous the comedian was, like they always asked that too. Like, was that okay? Was that good? Do you think the audience liked me? And people are human. They want to know. They want to be liked.
Exactly. I thought that was really like, I was like, I would have never thought, but yeah, I do it too. It's crazy.
Have you interviewed any like hardcore criminals?
Oh my God. No, I don't think so.
Like,
interviewed criminals.
Like anybody who's gone to jail?
Yes, I interviewed, the guy who Leonardo DiCaprio played in Catch Me If You Can, you know.
Oh yeah, Frank Abagnale.
I interviewed him as well. Yeah, exactly. So fascinating. He was a big criminal, but then he worked for the FBI, so I don't know if that counts.
Yeah, no, and a lot of times, you know, I interviewed someone recently who committed a fairly big fraud, like $400 million Ponzi scheme. And he went to jail for 9 years.
Wow.
And I think it was very important for me interviewing him that I didn't treat him like someone who did something really bad. But I still wanted to make sure my listeners knew that it was clear this person did something bad and I was against it. So it sometimes is a tricky thing.
Yeah. Because you're trying to be empathetic, but there has to be a clear line of like, you know, this is, I mean, we can all agree that what you did was not right.
You know, it was tricky too. Like I interviewed Andrew Tate You know, and Andrew Tate.
Oh man.
Obviously. Yeah. That's a whole mess. If you're trying to be liked by everybody, don't interview Andrew Tate because nobody will.
Right.
Everybody's going to make a judgment. Oh, you must agree with everything he says, or you must like him, or he used you, or whatever. And so sometimes the interviewer has to balance all of these things too.
Yeah, it's so hard. It's like, you know, these people's views would never go challenged if I didn't interview them. You know what I mean? Like, for anybody interviewing a dictator, are you just quote unquote giving them a platform, or are you interviewing them and challenging what they think so that more people can like hear that it's BS? I don't know. It's really difficult.
Like, let's say you had to interview Putin.
Okay.
So there's so many layers in which you could
I'm from Bulgaria. He's from Russia. This would be a tough one, James.
Right. Like, so your family, they might say, don't talk to him or whatever. And then people might think will make a judgment about whether you're a Democrat or a Republican.
Right.
Oh, you know, only Republicans would talk to Putin. But obviously, he would be a fascinating person to interview. I mean, he's a leader of Russia. He's conducting a war. Whether you agree with that war or not, no matter what he did, I would interview him.
Yeah. Well, it's so tricky. It's like the whole point of journalism in general is to interview people who are doing things that are newsworthy, that are affecting the world, all this stuff. By ignoring someone doesn't make them go away. In fact, it actually fuels them more. I don't know. There's a whole philosophical discussion on this.
Yeah, it gets back to the thing of you have to join a team and then only talk to the people that team approves.
Exactly. And it's like, I'm on nobody's team. I just want to hear the information and then challenge that information.
Yeah, like I was once on the podcast talking to Mehdi Hasan, who had this show on MSNBC.
Yes, there's a profile on him right now.
Oh yeah, I have seen that. And I told him I'm neutral. I really try very hard to be neutral so I could talk to everybody and not feel biased. And he said there's no way to be neutral. He challenged me on that. And we were going to follow up at some point and he was going to prove to me that I wasn't neutral. And maybe I'm not. I don't know. But
that's the thing. I mean, I guess nobody's truly neutral, but I also, you know, completely reject the idea that you're either a Republican or a liberal. Like, I don't fall into any category. It's like really hard. Maybe you're not neutral. You're just like not part of any one group.
Yeah. Where you have to like do everything that group says.
Yeah, exactly.
And, but then I wonder, look, the podcasts that are the most popular take a stance and are really biased.
That's true.
I'm just not like that.
Yeah. That's not your style.
And the good thing with what you do is that you could profile anybody. Yeah. So you're trying to take lessons from them. And so you could choose. You've seldom will profile like a political person.
That's the thing. Like, I truly believe that you can learn from awful people about what not to do. You know, like there's lessons in everybody. It's not just like the good, moral, whatever people that we put on these like pedestals. It's also the people like, oh, my God, look at how their life turned out. I don't want that at all.
Yeah, like who would you say is like the worst person in the world right now? Would you interview that person?
Oh my God, I don't even know. It's also like, you know, nobody is like only evil or only good, but there are some pretty bizarre.
Yeah, some people are insane, so like they are mentally ill and bad. But like,
okay, here's an example. So right now I'm working on an article that's similar to this interviewing techniques, but it's on public speaking. And I'm, you know, on Twitter I asked, who is the greatest public speaker of all time? And of course people came up with Hitler, Mussolini, a bunch of cult leaders, a bunch of other dictators. And I'm like, I get it. But in my article right now, I'm saying like, I understand that these people are probably amazing public speakers, I'm not going to include them just because I do not want to like feature their stories. But the world's greatest speakers all use similar techniques. That's not to say they did or did not use this. It's just I'm choosing, my editorial style is choosing not to include dictators and cult leaders in this article.
But it's really interesting because, like, you know, you're right. They all use similar techniques. And that's going to be a fascinating article when you write it. And I've written a lot about public speaking as well, because it is another thing like interviewing where you're trying to win over, just like in an interview, you're trying to win over an audience. And there are specific techniques to do it. And you have to be as genuine and sincere as possible as well. But like a dictator will, you know, for instance, a dictator uses Robert Cialdini's consistency
persuasion
technique. Yeah, like they'll use all his techniques. Like, you know, someone like Hitler might say something like, you know, wasn't your life awful before? And you know, when bread was like a gazillion marks, and people would say yes. And then when I became leader, wasn't your life better? And then it's a bigger yes. So it's like that consistency, like getting them to say a small yes to get them to a bigger yes. He was very effective at doing things like that.
Right.
You know, and cult leaders are like that as well.
Exactly. And it's just like up to the person. Like maybe you really don't like me. I am not entitled to be on your show. You know what I mean? Like it's just, I think that every person has like a freedom to have whoever they want on their platform. And if they want to interview Putin and ask him questions, it's their right. Like I have, you will not catch me not defending free speech.
Yeah, good. Good thing. And look, let's see, and you say here, the only way to become a masterful interviewer is to interview. Larry King conducted more than 60,000 interviews in his career. Oprah has done more than 37,000. Joe Rogan has hosted more than 21 guests on his podcast. It's really true. You've got to do things.
Yeah. And it's like once you think about 60,000 interviews, that is so many, or 37,000. And then people think about Joe Rogan, you know, oh, he has the biggest show, biggest podcast, but he's only done 2,100 recorded interviews on his show. So it's like, and you've done 1,500. So it's like, those are big numbers, but 60,000 is like a different universe.
Yeah. And, you know, and again, like he does, like Larry King, those specifically are interviews. And Joe Rogan, it still feels so much like conversations.
Yeah.
And I really almost aspire to that. But you have to use interview techniques. Like these are all really important techniques. But, you know, one thing I'm going to try at one point is just give everybody, like go on Twitter, give everybody the Zoom link and interview whoever just comes on.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, just to show that everybody's got a story. And like, of course, Brandon Stanton and Humans of New York does that really well. But
yeah, that's the thing. What I say is like, you don't have to have a podcast to do an interview or have a conversation. It's just like with any stranger, you can practice these skills and just become a better conversationalist.
Yeah. And like, what do you think though on TikTok or Instagram? I see all these guys who go up to people and say, hey, how much rent do you pay? And they say, oh, $15,000 a month in New York City. Can I get a tour of your apartment? And they give the tour. And like, so what do you think of that style where it's like there's one question and then they ask everybody and then the interview is around that.
I kind of like that. It's because it has an angle. So, you know, it's kind of like Hot Ones. The angle is I'm going to ask you these random questions while you eat spicy food. It's the same. It's like it has a slight point of view. So you know exactly what you're getting, but then it can go anywhere.
Yeah. And there's this voyeurism aspect.
Yeah.
So it's like, can you show me?
And it's the intimacy. It's like the most intimate thing you can show somebody is your home.
Right. And the guy, the main guy I'm thinking of who does this, I mean, maybe there's more than one, but the main guy I'm thinking who I always see who does this, he always says, can I sit in your bed?
Oh my God, I have not seen that.
Yeah, and it's usually like some really beautiful woman who he goes up to and says, hey, how much do you... Like, it usually starts there. Huh. So he's getting every voyeuristic aspect. And you kind of are left wondering, like, is he going to have sex with this girl? Like,
oh my God. It's
the kind of interview sort of is in that direction. Uh-huh. But I kind of like the, what do you do for a living guy? Like, I like that guy too.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to just like quickly build intimacy with someone in a way that's like, can I see your house? How much money do you make? What do you do for a living? Like all the things that people think make them who they are.
And I guess it is also the consistency thing. Like if you answer, like obviously we don't see all the rejections these people do. They only show us the Instagram reels of the people who answer. But if you're already answering, what do you do for a living? Or how much money do you make? Or what's your rent? You've already said something so personal that now it's wide open for the guy to ask anything.
Yeah, but I also think those people probably have pre-interviewed these people to get there. I don't think anybody's like, oh, well, we happen to be on the block where my apartment is. Let's go check it out.
I wonder, or if 9 times out of 10, he gets nothing and then
just maybe
1 time out of 100, maybe he gets lucky and the person pays $200,000 a month in rent and we can see their apartment.
You should have him on.
Yeah, that would be a good idea. Jay, who's listening to this, let's get that guy on. I want to figure out, because that's a little bit like what I used to do at this 3 a.m. idea I used to do for HBO in the 90s, which is, you know, why are you out at 3 in the morning? It was that kind of concept. Mm-hmm. And I always think I did the first podcast because I would put it on the internet, these interviews that I
that's crazy
was given permission to do. So
that's cool.
But Polina Pompliano,
thank you, James.
Such a great newsletter, The Profile. I love all of your newsletter. Every episode edition that comes out, I'm always a reader. You know, you always have at least one reader, which is me, as soon as you send it out. And you also wrote the book Hidden Genius about some of your more interesting profiles. And always great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And congratulations. I don't know if you said congratulations on second baby.
Thank you so much. A lot going on these days.
Yeah. Like how many editions do you put out a week?
One every Sunday and then sometimes one every Wednesday.
Okay. Yeah. I know. I've seen more than one a week from you. And are you going to keep, like, is this it now for life? Like you're going to just do this newsletter for life? You're making money and it's all good?
Well, I really love the newsletter. I have no reason to not do it. But I really enjoy it. I've done it for the last 7 years, every single week. But now my goal is to do more interviews. So if anybody listening needs, you know, moderating help or is hosting something where they need an interviewer, let me know.
Very good call to action there.
So, thank you.
And thanks so much, Polina, again. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Escape to Ocean City, Maryland, and discover a place that just feels lighter, where every day feels like Saturday, and French fries are a food group, where flip-flops are always in fashion, and seafood is always in season, where the boardwalk is bustling, and the beach is right outside your door, where you can rise with the tide and feel like a kid again. Ocean City, Maryland, somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at OCOcean.com.
Here you are, BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too. Aw, I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.